Okay. I think most of you all got the handouts back there. I numbered them in the order in which, pretty much in the order that we're going to go through. You'll notice, though, that most are double-sided, so the ones that are on the back may not be exactly in order, but I'll refer to them by the number that's up in the upper right-hand corner as we get to those. So I'd probably just keep those kind of in order. It'll make things a little bit easier so you're not having to flip through, I guess, 8 pieces of paper or something. Okay, so this is wetlands ecology and management, right? So it's the most, somebody say something like, what, where am I? most appropriate place for us to start this course is what is a wetland, and that might just be sound like, well, that's a pretty intuitive thing, duh, everybody knows what a wetland is. In fact, in the name it says wet, duh. Well, yeah, that is pretty simple, and I'm pretty confident that you all have a pretty good idea of what probably a wetland is. But what I'm really talking about today is establishing and building the understanding with you all of what are the jurisdictional criteria of a wetland. The jurisdictional criteria. These are the criteria that are used to regulate wetlands and identify by law whether a wetland is present or is not present. The lecture today is the foundation of what all environmental consulting firms use to go out and tell where the edge of a wetland is. There's a lot of money that's involved in the concepts of what I'm talking about today. If you want to become an environmental consultant, learn about wetland delineation, you can almost go anywhere in the country and get a job. There's a high demand for folks that know how to delineate wetlands. And what I'm going to talk to you about today is just starting to scratch the surface, but it is the legal definition of a wetland. Okay? All right, before we get to that and what are the criteria that define wetlands and really delving into each of those criteria, what are some common names of wetlands that you all have heard? And yeah, estuaries, marshes, exactly. Bayous, bogs, exactly. So there's, what's that? Swamps, yep. So there's lots of different common names that exist out there in English and in Spanish, like you see in the bottom right. Humedales is Spanish for wetlands. And then there's lots of other common names that they use in Latin America. And for some reason, my laser pointer isn't working. There it is. Okay, now we're going. Okay, so everything from estuaries like you see here to backwater swamps like we have, Cypress Tupelo swamps in Tennessee and down through the southeast, to the prairie pothole region of the Great Plains where there's these circular wetlands that have been carved out by glaciers, and this is a major area for breeding waterfowl. In fact, most of our birds that come through Tennessee are produced in this region of the Dakotas and Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and parts of Ontario, and then they fly down through our state. And we'll talk about the importance of all these wetlands with respect to the migratory path and the annual cycle of waterfowl later on. Okay, so just in general, we can think about wetlands as ecotones. Have y'all heard that term before? Ecotone? Okay. Ecotones are referring to transitional ecosystems. Okay. So from one ecosystem to another ecosystem. And there isn't a better definition of an ecotone than a wetland for the most part. Because you're often transitioning between a terrestrial upland environment and an aquatic environment. Not always, but that's the typical case. Okay? So wetlands tend to have, when you have ecotones, you tend to have characteristics of both the terrestrial environment and the aquatic environment. And because they're in this transition zone, species that do depend on the terrestrial and aquatic environment often will depend and will use wetlands. And so we'll talk about the values of wetlands and the functions of wetlands later on. And a lot of those functions and values have to do with how they influence communities in the adjacent systems, the aquatic system and the terrestrial system. Really awesome, productive systems. Okay? And certainly there are some wetlands that really technically don't have an aquatic zone, which we'll define those criteria here in just a second. Okay? They're ephemeral wetlands, meaning that they dry up at some time and often even on an annual basis. So they'll just go from terrestrial to the wetland to they don't have an aquatic deep water system. Okay. Good. Any questions? All right. So, what is a wetland? And there are three characteristics. And before you look at that, everybody look up at me, eyes up at me. What makes sense? Let's just see if we can come up with these criteria. What should we have if we are a wet land? Water, exactly. So we should have water. That is a criteria. Water has to be out there for a certain amount of time. And because of water, it drives two other things that are necessary. Yeah. The plants that are there, the plants will respond. Certain plants respond to wet conditions, okay? And the reason they respond to those wet conditions is because when you cover water, the substrate with water, usually that substrate goes from an aerobic to an anaerobic state. And there are only certain plants that can deal with those types of stressors. And those plants are called hydrophytes. And we'll define those here in just a second. Okay. And then somebody else, I heard it. The other criteria?
The hydric soils.
The hydric soils, exactly. So there's three criteria. And hydric soils are a consequence of water being on them and going from an aerobic to an anaerobic state. There are anaerobic characteristics that become present in hydric soils. So you don't need to know this long definition here of what they are. Lands transitional between terrestrial and aquatic, okay, blah, blah, blah. Where the water table is usually at or near the surface of the land, the land is shallowly covered with water, okay? All right, now there are three attributes, three characteristics, which we just mentioned. And these are all outlined in the 1987 Army Corps of Engineers Wetland Delineation Manual. We'll talk about a little bit of that history. It just probably is one of the most bizarre things that you've ever heard of. The Army Corps of Engineers Wetland Delineation Manual. What in the heck is the Corps doing being responsible for delineating and regulating wetlands? Well, they are the regulatory agency, and we'll talk about that history. And all of the criteria are outlined, and this is what we follow to this day, is the 87 manual. There was a 92 manual, but they went back to the 87 manual because it created too many questions among agencies. Okay, so the three attributes, and we're going to go into each of these in quite a bit of detail. So wetlands have to periodically support hydrophytes, and we'll define hydrophytes here in a second. The website that you see here is a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service website that has a list of all the plants in the United States. You can go to this website, and you can look up this list of plants, and it will tell you what their classification is, and we'll talk about different classifications of hydrophytes here in a second. But is it a hydrophyte or isn't it? okay, and how much of a hydrophyte it is. Okay. So you can go to that website. All right. Two, hydric soil. Substrate is a hydric soil. And the definition, even though the Corps is in charge of this, the definition is established by NRCS, Natural Resources Conservation Service, which used to be the Soil Conservation Service. So they filed the criteria, filed the hydric soils criteria of NRCS. And finally, the substrate is saturated, is covered or saturated for at least 5% of the growing season. That's critical. 5%, at least 5% of the growing season. And the reason is that there's quite a bit of research out there, y'all, that indicates that you will have a wetland if surface water is present you will always have a wetland if surface water is present for longer than about 12.5% of the growing season. And down to, so in this range here between 5 and 12%, you may or you may not have a wetland. It may or may not support hydrophytes or have hydric soil. Okay? So the criteria here is that, well, at least 5% of the growing season. You have to have standing water during 5% of the growing season. And then you have to have the other criteria. You have to have the soils and you have to have the hydrophytes. Then it is a wetland. If it is over 12.5%, it's always a wetland. Okay? It's over 12.5%. It's always going to be a wetland. You don't even have to look at the other criteria. Now, how do you figure out that 5%? Because that would be a good idea, you know. How many days does that mean for Knox County? There's a website you can go to, and we're going to talk about that here in just a moment. Okay. All right. So, is that clear, y'all? Now, what happens here, so you have to have all three of these characteristics in order to be a wetland. Well, let's say that you're a devious developer and you're aware of these three criteria. All right. Now, there are some restrictions with respect to going in and dredging, and we'll talk about that. So you say, well, let's remove one of these, because if one of these is gone, then it isn't a wetland, therefore regulations can't apply to me. And I can go in and fill the wetland in or do whatever I want to do. Well, if it has all these characteristics and you go and you try to remove the water, that's probably meaning you're going to have to fill in something or dig stuff out. That could violate federal law, which we'll talk about in just a little bit. That's why I said could, because there's some circumstances. But one obvious thing is well, why don't we just remove the hydrophytes? So, for example, if we have a cypress, we could just go cut all the trees. And there are criteria. It has to be the dominant vegetation. We cut all the trees, they aren't there, right? Okay, so what happens if something like this happens? So what if the vegetation is cleared, or what if a highway is constructed through a wetland, and obviously where that highway is it a wetland anymore if those criteria disappear? Okay, So this brings up the first concept from the on the first handout called normal circumstances. All right. And basically normal circumstances are that all of these criteria are necessary and exist under normal circumstances. It is not normal for somebody to go out and to cut the vegetation to remove one of these. And so if one of these have been removed outside of non-normal circumstances, it still is a wetland. And those types of assessments are made by officials either in the Corps or some other agency and said, no, this is certainly not normal circumstances. You've altered it. Okay? Is that clear? Now, can you alter wetlands? Can you fill wetlands? Can you? Yeah, you can. You certainly you can. You have to get permission to do it, but you can. So in the case like building roads or even putting out, you know, Walmart in their parking lot or something, they fill a wetland. They can get approval to do that. What happens? Is it still a wetland once the highway goes through? Well, because you're going to, obviously, there aren't going to be any more hydrophytes there, at least where the road is itself. There still may be wetland, portions of wetlands around it, but not where it is, where the road is sitting, and you're not going to have these other criteria. So, is it a wetland anymore? What do you guys think? No? No, it isn't, because it does, it certainly is not a normal circumstance, but approval has been granted, and it doesn't have these characteristics any longer, and it's no longer a wetland. Now, if you do this, then in Tennessee and pretty much in every other state, then you're going to have to compensate for that destruction through a process called mitigation. And we won't go into too much about mitigation, but I'll talk a little bit about it later on. Okay? Good? All right, so that's a wetland, and those are the criteria that define a wetland, and we'll talk about each one of those in quite a bit of detail here. All right, upper limits. Yeah, often the goal of wetland delineation is to find the upper limits of the wetland. Because usually when you're at least outside of natural resources and being kind of interested, here's our wetland, and maybe classifying the wetland, which we're going to talk about next Monday, a lot of environmental consultants are finding the edge of the wetland, so basically developers can build up to it. So you find where these criteria disappear when you're delineating wetlands. So you're going from where it's definitely wet to where it disappears, and you create a map. That is wetland delineation, delineating the edge of that wetland. Wetland classification, which is next Tuesday, Monday, excuse me. Hey, there we go. Big piece of chalk here. Oh, there's a bunch over there. So let's say we have a wetland here. Delineating is doing the edge. Classifying is actually coming in and talking about, you know, what are these different types. You may have several different kinds of wetlands that are classified differently by the by Fish and Wildlife Service. So classification is U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And there's no regulatory power with classification. It's a biological classification system. There is regulations with respect to delineation. Okay. All right. Good? Whoa. I just flipped through a bunch of slides. Any questions? Okay, so the next thing is, and I only use this term just because this is the term they used in 1979, and I hate it. What is a deep water habitat? What we're really talking about is, where does the aquatic system begin? Where does the wetland system end and the aquatic system begin? But back then they called it deep water habitat. These are permanently flooded areas, zones, beyond the deep water boundary of wetlands. And where is that zone as far as federal jurisdiction, federal criteria? Okay. Yeah, so this is the area where, where water, not air, drives the system. Substrate is non-soil, and it prevents usually emergent, because it's too so deep, it prevents emergent hydrophyte growth. And what I mean by emergent hydrophytes, these are emergent hydrophytes. They are emerging, these are wetland plants, okay, and they're emerging from the water. You may have some submergent plants out here. Okay, the distinction is 2 meters. That's the delineation. That's based on quite a bit of research. It indicates that usually that's about the point where you don't have a whole lot of rooted plant growth anymore. So over 2 meters is the edge of the wetlands. Now this is in freshwater non-tidal wetlands. If you, where the deep water zone starts, the marine zone or starts is classified differently for, again, marine systems or tidal systems. And we don't go into that in this class, but we do in advanced wetlands. Just if you're interested, it's at the low level point of the low tide of the low level mark of spring tides. Spring tides have the greatest fluctuation, and it's at the farthest point of the spring, the low level point of spring tides. That actually is where that is the end of the wetland. There are some other criteria though too, but we'll go to that. All right. That's where, no. See, I probably shouldn't even have mentioned the tides. This is in a non-tidal system. Oh. This is strictly non-tidal, period. Period. Yeah. Okay.
So even if there's no vegetation growing, up to, if I go out 5 feet and there's no vegetation, it's still considered wetlands and it's within that range, or does there have to be vegetation growth?
There does not have to be vegetation growth. Good question. Out to 2 meters depth. Yeah. Other questions? Okay, so let's start off with the hydrophyte criteria. So what are hydrophytes? Well, what would you think they are? Hydrophyte, water-loving plants. That's exactly it. They like water, all right? And you don't need to know all this jargon here, but this is the core of engineers' definition. Ultimately, what it is a plant in which basically water drives its life cycle. So a macrophytic plant life that occurs in areas where the frequency and duration of inundation or soil saturation produce permanently or periodically saturated soils of sufficient duration to exert a controlling influence on the plant species present. So just like we talked about earlier, water's driving this, and water is driving the species that are present. The species that are present can deal with that type of stressor. And that type of stressor is a lack of oxygen to the roots, period. okay? Got to keep your roots alive. And we'll talk about some plant adaptations in a little bit. All right. Now, what you do need to know, these are one of these details that I just make you remember, is you need to know the classifications, the core classifications for how much it is a hydrophyte, or really how least it is a hydrophyte. The first is called obligate wetland. And the acronym here is OBL. You need to know both. And you need to know these ranges that are on the right side. So obligate wetland plant. Okay, these are plants that are always in wetlands. So what might some of those things be? When you always see in wetlands. Cattails are always, yeah, right? Cattails are there. Yeah, like, there we go, right there. Cattails. What else do I have on the slide?
Buttonbush.
Yeah, buttonbush, definitely.
Milfoil
would be one, yeah. Yeah, I like your submergent plants, definitely. Lilies, yeah. Bald cypress. Now, they can be planted in, you know, as ornamentals. You'll see them not in a wetland, but that doesn't count. Okay. Facultative wetland. Facultative wetland, acronym is FACW. F-A-C-W, FACW. So most of the time, over two-thirds of the time, they're in wetlands. We're talking about, and some of these plants may be a little bit, you may not know what they are, like smartweed. You should know what green ash is from taking dendro. But you're going to learn those plants this afternoon. So smartweed is one of those that you pretty much always see. Yeah?
What does the percentage mean?
Okay, so what does the percentage mean? This means how often you expect to see this plant in a wetland. 68 to 99% of the time. So not always will you find smartweed in a wetland, but two-thirds of the time you will. It's a very good indicator of a wetland. Same with green ash. You won't always find it in a wetland, but it's a pretty good indicator that you're in wetland conditions, a bottomland type condition. And remember that there's that Fish and Wildlife Service table, that website you can go to, that has all plants, every tree listed, and it has them classified. And it will have, we'll have to visit the website here, it'll have these classifications, indicate what it is, and it'll have these acronyms for a particular plant. Okay? Next, facultative. FAC. All right? So facultative includes everywhere from just a third to two-thirds of the time. All right. And these could be anything from barnyard grass, which is millet, to cottonwood. So certainly cottonwoods can be down in a wetland. A lot of times they aren't. Okay? And so a lot of the plants that we try to stimulate through our management practices in wetlands often fall into this group here. They're annual seed-producing plants that respond pretty quickly. That they're found in wetlands, but not all the time, such as barnyard grass. Okay. There's facultative upland, which is FACU. So I know what it sounds like. FACU. they're not very often found in wetlands. Okay. One very common one, and this is an important one. Make sure you circle this. Cocklebur, which you see in wetlands a lot, is not a wetland plant. Okay. Cockle burr responds very quickly in response to a drawdown, and everybody knows cockle burr. Well, we've got it on your plant list. If you don't, it's the big burr that you get on you when you're walking through, through areas and stay on you for about ever. And those seeds also float around, and so they have an excellent dispersal capability, and they germinate very, very, very quickly. And they often establish within wetlands, and they often, they're a nuisance plant when it comes to being a wetland manager because they're very broadleaf. They get up above your annual grasses, and they'll shade them out and outcompete them. And so we'll talk about controlling cockle burr. One thing you can do with cockle burr is you can flood it. You'll kill it. That's one thing you like. But if your grasses up below it aren't tall enough, if you overtop those, you'll kill those too. So... Now, there are also other things, some herbicides you can use that we'll talk about later. But cockle burr is not a wetland plant, actually. And then finally, there's obligate upland, less than 1%. Now, okay, the reason for this color coding here is that these two are not upland plants. They are upland plants, excuse me. They're not wetland plants. These three are wetland plants where facultative, a portion of them are. Okay. If they are classified, each of these categories can be further classified based on their affinity to water. And so within FACW, you can have a plus or a minus. A plus means that you are towards the higher end of this percentage. A minus means you're towards the lower end of this percentage. Okay? So, wetland plants include obligate, facultative wetland, both plus and minus. Okay? FAC plus, FAC, and then they do not include FAC minus. Okay? So if they're classified just as straight up FAC, which is generally right in the center, FAC plus, which is towards the higher end of this percentage, FACW minus or plus or FACW or obligate, okay, they're wetland plants. Non-wetland plants are FAC minus, FACU, and upland, okay? Yes, sir.
So FAC minus down are your non.
Exactly. FAC minus down are your non-wetland plants. That's correct. Now, all right. Does it mean that if you have one FAC minus plant, it's not a wetland? No, it doesn't. The criteria for the core is that the plant community, whatever it is, a wetland is classified, or the hydrophyte criteria is classified based on dominant plants. What is the dominant plant community? Okay? Is it mostly hydrophytes or is it mostly non-hydrophytes? And it also is not just the grass strata, but it's the grass, the shrub strata, and the tree strata. They also can also consider vines as well. Okay, we'll talk about that here in just a second. So it's dominance, based on dominance, and that level is 50%. Now, the next question is, how do you measure dominance? Right? Well, some lawyers ask that too. So the core has criteria. And those criteria that we follow, the criteria is called the 50-20 dominance rule. And sometimes when you take ecology, they teach you that, and sometimes they don't. It just depends on where you took and who you took it from. But we'll go through that. Is that clear?
50-20 dominance rule?
Yes, sir. 50-20 dominance rule. Whoa! Okay. All right. So, the core looks at measuring dominance, again, and they look across four different strata. The first is what's called the herb strata, which is short for herbaceous. So it's all herbaceous plants, and woody plants that are less than 3.2 feet tall. Does include woody plants less than 3.2 a meter tall. There's the sapling and shrub layer, which is woody plants greater than basically a meter tall, but they're less than 3 inches DBH. There's a tree layer, all woody plants greater than 3 inches DBH, regardless of height. And then there's woody vine. This is pretty much not used very often, but it's in there. So usually we're talking about these criteria. You'd have to have lots of woody vines. Morning glory can get that way. Yeah, there are cases where you can have lots of vines dominating a system, but most of the time this isn't the case, usually in here. Okay, so how do you, first of all, how do you measure dominance? Outside of the dominance rule, which we'll talk about, you have to go out there and measure. There's lots of different ways in which you can measure whether a plant or an animal is dominant out there in a particular area. One is whether or not it occurs there. This is presence-absence data. It occurs, it doesn't occur. One is percent horizontal cover, which is often done. And so, not sure how much you learned in measurements and sampling, or if Jason covered this, but there's lots of different ways in which you can, you can have a wetland here. Oops, sorry. And you can measure presence absence, maybe on a transect. Every 10 meters, you basically are looking to see what are the plants around this area. And presence absence is just, is it there or not, right? So that's one way. Well, okay. Now, another way is that instead of just looking at presence absence, you actually, within where maybe you stop, you have a plot. And you look in that plot and you look at, okay, about how much area does this cover? Okay, so within, let's do a 1 by 1 meter plot. And you're looking down there in a 1 by 1 meter plot, and you're looking to see, ultimately, is more than 50% of this covered by hydrophytes. And then another way you can do it is you can actually count every single darn plant that's in here. So this is horizontal cover. And then lastly is density, which is counting every single plant, which I think you all did do some density plot estimation, that type of stuff, probably in measurements. Okay. In wetlands, we really kind of go in and talk about what plot size you, advanced wetlands, what plot size you would use. You actually have an exercise where you go out and do this stuff. Just very quickly, for the herbaceous stuff, it's usually just a 1 meter square plot. For the saplings, and you don't really need to remember this, but if you want to just write it down for your own professional interest. For this sapling shrub layer, it's a 40 meter square plot. Excuse me. It's a 100 meter square plot. And for the tree layer, it's a 400 meter square plot. Okay? So we have 1 meter square, 100 meter square, and 400 meter square. And you're looking within those plots. And again, the plots, you can do density or you can do horizontal cover for any of these strata. It gets a little more challenging with the shrub and the tree strata to do horizontal cover because you're kind of standing within a plot that could be the size of this room going, okay, you know, about how much of this plot is covered by a particular shrub or tree. Okay, so usually when you deal with these strata, 2 and 3, you use density. When you do herbaceous, though, usually you do horizontal cover because counting every single plant, even in a 1 meter square plot, is you'll go batty. I mean, it just takes too much time. Okay? Is that clear? All right.
When you do density for trees, do you take how many trees are like per acre, or do you go ahead and add it to like crayon size and stuff like that?
Yeah, so what you would do, let's say this was our 400 meter square plot here, okay? We would count every single tree that was in here, regardless of whether its crown went outside the plot or not, okay? But if you were going to do horizontal cover, you would probably get right in the center of the plot and look to see how much of the plot is really being covered by the crown of the plants that are there. So, you know, really, probably density is the best when it gets to the woody plants. And then horizontal cover, you know, I'd use for the herbaceous plants. Okay, any other questions? All right. Yeah, see I have this little box down here that says the best. Well, it's really right next to that. Go ahead and write next to that. It's the best probably for 2 and 3, but percent horizontal cover is best for number 1. All right. Relative occurrence, this presence absence is not that great. Why do you think? Well, I mean, that's a good point. It's in the seed bank and it's not showing yet. That's a good point, but that could also be the case too with percent horizontal cover. But any other thoughts?
Yeah.
Number 4? Oh, as far as these guys, kind of depends on the growth form, but a lot of these things are crawling plants or crawling vines that certainly can climb, but like Ipomoea morning glory, which you'll find in wetlands, horizontal cover is probably the best. So really, if I was going to recommend, I would do 1 and 4 within the 1 meter square plots, 2 and 3 within I do density within the larger plots. Percent presence absence. Yeah, you could have, you know, just presence and absence. You could just have one plant here. Well, it is present after all. But it really isn't getting a good feel of its dominance within a plant community. So you could have 99 hydrophyte plants and it gets one. All right? Oh yeah, well there was one non-hydrophyte too. It gets a one as well. So you end up losing a lot of that dominance information. So. Okay. All right. So let's go ahead and do, we'll do an example here in just a second from our handout. I'm going to take you through this, and I'm going to just kind of flip through the steps because we're going to work through the steps here in a second. So the process of going through the 50-20 dominance rule is measure the response variable, meaning the vegetation response variable. You go out and you measure, may have, again, this is your transect here. You measure horizontal cover or density. You rank all of the species within a stratum, again, herb or the, you do it separately, okay? Within each stratum, herb and shrub and trees, from least to most abundant, or most to least abundant, excuse me. You calculate the total density or total percent cover across the species and compute percent dominance. Get an idea of, again, how dominant these things, each of them are. You sum percent dominance across the species until it's greater than 50%, and those are your dominant species. And then you include any other species that has greater than 20% individual dominance.
What do you mean by individual dominance?
We'll talk about, we'll do an example in just a second, but one particular species has itself has greater than 20% dominance, just one species. It may not have fallen in the greater than 50% category as we were adding up, but it has greater than 20% individual dominance.
So it's between 20 and 50%.
What's that?
It's between 20 and 50%.
Yeah, and it really has to do with that. It also means that, like, for example, if you had a plant species, you could have one plant species that has 55% dominance. Okay? So what you do is you sum up until you're over 50%. You have them ranked. Well, you hit the first plant and you're over 50%. You stop. Okay? You have another plant below it that was ranked number two. It has 25% dominance, and then maybe the rest of them are 10% or small percentages below 20. So what you would do is you would say, as far as what are the dominant plant species, it's this one that is certainly greater than 50%, and it's also this one that has individual dominance that's greater than 20%. Okay, so you would include both those. Those are both dominant plants. Then you would see what those are. Are they wetland plants or aren't they wetland plants? you could have two species that were 30%. So you went, plant species one was 30%, plant species two was 30%, so that's 60% stop. Then you have one that's 22% or something. Well, then you would include that one as well. But it wouldn't have been included in that first count up to 50%. Is that clear? It'll hopefully be clear when we do an example. Okay? Then you repeat the steps for the other stratum. So you do it for the herbaceous stratum. If you have any other stratum, you may not. You might be out in just an emergent wetland. If you're done with that, you're done. If you need to go back and do the other stratum, then you do the other stratum. You add across all the stratums, and then you look to see, are over half of these dominant plants, are over half the dominant plants hydrophytes? If they are, it meets the hydrophyte criteria. Okay? Oops. Okay. So let's go ahead and do an example here.
So if you have 50% green ash and it covers the right amount of time, it's a wetland? Or is it just like, no matter what your species are, they're back or above, you have 50% combination, a little bit of herb, a little bit of
okay.
Tree. That's a wetland. Or if it's 100% green ash, but it meets the other criteria, or 50%, it's still a wetland, right?
Okay, so this, if you meet the plant criteria, okay, through the 50-20 rule, you meet the hydrophyte criteria for the core. Which means, yes, that criteria is met, but you still need to have hydric soil, and you still need to have the water. So it meets one of the criteria. And so that's what this whole process is to see, is that criteria met? Okay. So you have an example here. Shut it? Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely. You have an example here that I handed out, and it gives an example on one side, this is handout two, example on the other side, okay? So that's for your practice. I'm going to do a different one on the board so that you have a third example. All right, so everybody get out a piece of paper if you don't have one yet. And hello. Sorry about that. All right. For those that are at home or doing the, if you're listening, studying, hopefully you don't hate me already. This is like talking in the future to you all. Okay. So we're doing an example on 50-20 dominance. Okay. So let's say this is start off strata. Some space here. Okay, this is going to be the herbaceous strata, and we'll have another strata too. And plant, 1, 2, 3, 4, four plants, well, four different plant species, excuse me. And this is, let's say we do this in our 1 meter square plot. This is horizontal cover. For those that are over there. And we identify the plant and we either know or we look up its classification on the Fish and Wildlife Service website. And we find out that this is species 1 is FAC, species 2 is FAC plus, species 3 is FAC, and species 4 is FAC minus. And here's our measure. Again, this is going to be, we'll just call this our measure of dominance. And this is going to be horizontal cover within this 1 meter square frame. Well, these all should add up to 100%
whenever you do this.
So let's say this one was 60%. Again, you're just eyeballing it. Like, okay, about 60. 10, 5, and 25. Sorry about that. All right. Our next strata is the shrub layer. And I guess we did this within our 100 meter square plot, and we got density. And we have another four species here. These are classified as FAC, FAC minus, FAC U, and upland. And the density here, now remember this is density here, is 5, 7, 6, and 2. Now this is density. Yeah, so this should add up to 100 because they're percentages themselves that we're estimating. But these are just numbers of shrubs within this 100 meter square plot. Okay, if we do add these up, because we're going to need to do that, right? So we can figure out percent dominance, that equals 20. All right, so the first thing to do is to calculate relative dominance or percent dominance. Well, you can rank them too, but whichever, we'll do percent dominance first. All right. So percent dominance, we have percent here. These are percentages. So this is the same thing. I mean, these are the same number. 60%, 10%, 5%, 25%. Okay. When you have density to get percent dominance, you have to, first of all, add these up. So on a test, what would I give you guys? I'd give you right to here and say, all right, figure out whether or not this wetland meets hydrophyte criteria based on the 50-20 rule. Okay? So if you have horizontal cover, which is only going to be the case with the herbaceous cover here, then you're going to be given percentages. I'll indicate that it's just that's your percent dominance. Shrubs or trees, you're going to have to add up the density. So in order to calculate relative or percent dominance, then 5 divided by 20, 7 divided by 20, 6 divided by 20, 2 divided by 20 to come up with a percent. Need a little bit more room, don't I? So 25%, 35%, 30%, and 10%. Now, all of those definitely should add up to 100%. Okay. So just a way you can kind of double check your math. So again, one of the reasons you need to bring a calculator to the test. All right. Now, so it says to within each of these strata, what we want to do is you can rank them, and you can just inspect. I mean, you don't necessarily need to write them all out. You can pretty much rank them just through by seeing them, following the rule. The rule is that what we do is we start with the most abundant individual within a strata, okay? Within a strata. Well, this is obviously the most abundant. We add up all of the percentages until we exceed 50%. So how many of these do we add up, and which one is it? First one. You stop. Boom. So in this column we have, what are our dominants? All right, well, definitely number one is a dominant. Okay. Then it says, all right, you've exceeded 50%, you stop. Are there any other species there that have greater than 20% dominance? Number four does, right here. These are your dominant plants in the herbaceous strata. You do the same thing for the shrub strata. Okay, so what's our most dominant one?
Two.
Number two is. You add up consecutively the most common plants until you exceed 50%. So do we stop right there? No, we don't. We're at 35%. We're not greater than 50%. So what do we do next?
Three.
Yeah, number three is the next most common. Are we greater than 50% at that point? Yeah, because that's 65%. So we have two and three. Do we have any other plant species that are greater than 20%? Yes, we do. Which one?
One.
Number one. So that's also considered a dominant species. These are all given equal weights regardless of their relative percentage. Okay, these are now considered the dominant plants. Okay, now what it says is combine the list across the dominant of the list of dominants across the strata. So I'm going to go on the other side here, and your dominant plants. Let's just go ahead and write out their classification. What is 1 and 4? So 1 is fac, correct? 4 is fac minus. And then in the other strata, we have 1, 2, and 3. Is that right? Okay. And what are their classifications?
One is
back. Uh-huh.
Two is
back minus. 3 is vacuum. All right. Okay. So, now we simply classify this. Is back hydrophyte or non-hydrophyte?
Hydrophyte.
Hydrophyte. Back minus. Non-hydrophyte. Back. Hydrophyte. Back minus is non-hydrophyte. What about fac U? Non-hydrophyte. Okay. Remember the rule. Are 50% of these dominant plants, do they fall into these categories? So are over half of these hydrophytes? No. 3 of 5 are non-hydrophytes. Therefore, it does not meet the hydrophyte criteria. The wetland hydrophyte criteria, excuse me. Established by the Corps. So it wouldn't meet it. If one of these was H, then we'd meet it. Now when you first look at this, you see, I mean, let's look actually across this. You have 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. And then you have 1, 2, 3, 4. Looks pretty even. But when it comes down to the measure of dominance, it is the non-hydrophytes that are more dominant at this particular site. Okay? And this would be, y'all, oops, I already erased it. But when I had that plot up there, it would be at one, for example, sampling across the wetland or getting outside of the wetland, it would be at one plot. And then you would do it at another plot. So doing wetland delineation, at least that is going to be potentially challenged in a court of law, is a very rigorous process where you're going through and you're measuring plants and you're getting percentages and you're doing it multiple locations, etc. And they charge a lot for it too. A relatively simple process. Okay.
What do you do if it's exactly 50% hydrophyte and non-hydrophyte?
Good question. What do you do if it's exactly 50%? What does our rule say?
Greater.
It has to be greater. If it's exactly 50%, it doesn't meet it. Good question. Yep, Corps of Engineers strictly interprets inequalities directly. Okay, good. Any questions? Pretty simple. Think you can roll through one of those problems.
Is there any certain time of year that's recommended to do these measurements?
Good question. What time of year should this be done? The time of year this should be done is towards the end of the growing season. But it's done because that's when everything is present, assuming it's not a drought year. Last year was, in teaching wetlands, was the craziest year in teaching it because it's the worst time of year or worst year you could have done it. But it should be done towards the end of the growing season so that you know what is there and what is dominant, what's, you know, the most common species. So what I would say is it should be done, ideally, between July and October, at least in our area. Now, it certainly, right now, they're environmental consultants because they're busy sending folks out, and they're doing stuff right, well, maybe not right now, but in early spring. But when you're measuring dominance based on from the herbaceous community, I mean, you can't identify what most of the things are because they're just little pieces of grass. I don't care how good you are with that. You have to either wait until they get a little bit more mature into the summer, then you can identify those or grow them in a greenhouse. And maybe in some cases they do that. They just collect plant species and grow them out. Other questions? Okay. So, hydric soils. We're done with that. Pretty wild, huh? Amazing it takes that long to tell you what a hydrophyte is. Okay, hydric soils. So, it's a soil that is associated with wet conditions. All right, so this is NRCS's definition. Again, you do not need to be able to regurgitate this, but you should know what creates a hydric soil outside of water being on it, and that is the anaerobic conditions that result from being flooded, from breaking off the atmospheric connection and going from an aerobic to an anaerobic state. And so anaerobic respiration and transformation of chemicals within that soil are based on anaerobes. They occur at a much slower rate than what occurs with microbes that rely on aerobic respiration. Consequently, decomposition is much slower in a flooded situation than in a dry situation. Okay, so these are soils that are saturated, flooded, or ponded long enough during the growing season to develop anaerobic conditions that favor growth and regeneration of hydrophytic vegetation. Okay, first and foremost, what is a hydric soil? If it is an organic soil, it is a hydric soil. If it's an organic soil, it is a hydric soil. All organic soils fall in the order histosols, and it includes all histosols except for one case, and those are the fallous. Okay? So if you know you have an organic soil, then boom, you meet it. You're done. Don't need to look at anything else. The other things that we look at outside of being it or whether it's organic or not are kind of general characteristics that are associated with becoming anaerobic, which are like visual characteristics that you see in a soil, which we'll talk about. So just to bring this back from maybe, if you're fortunate enough, in your soils class to break down the histosols, we have the fallous, which are on top, which are not, those are not hydric soils. They're not hydric soils. The ones on the bottom are saprous, hemis, and fibrous. And the gradient goes from just being slightly decomposed with the fibrous to saprous being highly decomposed. So these are on poorly drained soils at the bottom and well-drained soils on the top. And because they're on poorly drained soils, water's there a lot. You have, again, decomposition occurs at slow rates in flooded soils. And you have an accumulation of organic matter. Correspondingly, organic soils are all considered hydric soils except for the fallous. These fallous mostly occur in tropical areas. Okay. So. All right. Now, you have two opportunities here. You can have an organic soil and have a mineral soil. Organic, good, done. If you're mineral, then we're going to have to look at other characteristics. All right, before we jump into those characteristics, what is a mineral soil? How can we determine a mineral soil? How many folks had soils? Everybody, right? You progressed. Okay, good. So, oh yeah, we'll talk about that on the next slide. There is one criteria that is used a lot by consultants, and it is approved by the Corps of Engineers to use. If you know something about the hydrology of the site during the growing season, and specifically, if you know that on that site it is flooded for most of the years, for at least 7 consecutive days, The Corps says that is okay. You don't even have to look at the soil. All the stuff we're going to talk about next. If you just know that it's flooded for 7 consecutive days, then it meets the hydric soil criteria. Why? Because all the things that I'm going to talk about as far as indicators of hydric soils, it takes about 7 days for those to become apparent. 7 days of flooding. So if you know that it's flooded for 7 days, you don't have to look. But you have to, if you're going to be in a court of law, you have to make sure either you or somebody who's working for you has physically been out there, or you've taken pictures, and if you're out there, you better take pictures that are time-stamped and all that stuff. Okay. Or you have some other information that allows you aerial photos or some type of use of GIS, which we'll talk about a little bit here later on, to kind of get an idea how long it could be flooded. Okay, so that question will come up, and I guarantee you half of you will get it wrong. Because what you're going to tell me is the question will say is based on NRCS or U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, what's the minimum amount of time that a soil can be flooded, and you can, and it means it's a hydric soil. And I will have on there 5%, 5% of the growing season, 7 days of the growing season, some other stuff, 12.5%. And invariably, nobody picks, or very few folks, unless you're listening right now or you're listening to the podcast, you're not going to put 7 days. Because what you're going to lock into your mind is the 5% and the 12.5%, which we'll talk about with respect to hydrology, the hydrology criteria. Keep those separate. This is soil. And if you know that it's flooded for 7 days, okay, it meets the soil criteria. I'll tell you right now, 7 days isn't enough to meet the hydrology criteria, which is 5% of the growing season. In Tennessee, it's about double that. That's about 5% of the growing season is double that. Yeah.
Is that 7 days or greater than 7 days?
It is greater than 7 days. Excuse me. Greater than 7 days. Yeah. Okay.
So that creates the hydric soils, but not the hydrology.
It meets the hydric soil criteria, but not the hydrology criteria. Okay, which we're going to be talking about in more depth in a little bit, but that is 5% of the growing season. Okay?
Flooded, understanding water.
It can be saturated, flooded or saturated. Okay, so in other words, that soil, when you step on it, saturated means you step on it and water comes out of it. It has to be saturated or standing water. That's correct. Okay? Good? All right. So, you know, if it's organic, we're good. If it's mineral, well, what's a mineral soil? Just to take you back to soils class, a couple last year or year before, or whenever you took it. All right. I'm going to tell you this, y'all. I'm going to provide a lot of details here, but really what I want you to know is at the very end, because there's lots of different criteria that break you into whether you're a mineral soil or an organic soil, and it comes down to one rule of thumb at the end. It, first of all, depends on if you're flooded frequently or not frequently. If you're not flooded very infrequently, so less than 30 days or something, this is over the whole year, then if you have less than 20% dry weight or organic carbon, then you are a mineral soil. So it has to do with if you're flooded frequently and how much organic carbon you have. Okay? So you, in order to be organic, you'd have to have greater than 20%. So less than 20%, in this case, flooded infrequently, mineral soil. This is pretty much the case when you're going to be, well, not necessarily. Okay, if you're flooded for longer durations, then it depends on the clay content. And there's all these different rules that if you have, okay, you're flooded for long duration, so greater than 30 days during the whole year, okay? You're a mineral soil if you're less than 18% organic carbon, if there's a lot of clay, over 60% clay. You are an organic, if there is no clay, then you're organic if, excuse me, you're mineral if you have less than 12%. And you're flooded for long duration. And then there's this variation also in between. So, at a minimum, okay, you could either know all of these things, or if you're going to look at whether or not a soil is organic, which I'll show you, we normally do just the soil probe, and you pull it up and you look to see how much organic material is in here very quickly. A good rule of thumb is just following this, because it is the greatest percentage of all, which is 20%. If you are greater than 20% organic carbon, greater than or equal to 20% organic carbon, you're always going to be an organic soil, period. Regardless of how long you're flooded, regardless of how much clay you have, you're always organic. So, consultants that really are, that you know, do this for a living will use these rules a lot. But a good rule of thumb is just 20%. So you do a soil core, and you take a look, and you take a section of that, and you're like, is about 20% of this organic or not? Doesn't really look like it. Okay, it's not organic, it's mineral. If it's mineral, what does that mean? You don't have a hydric soil? No, that does not mean that. You have to look for other criteria. Okay, so organic is, as I just mentioned, is greater than, always going to be greater than 20%. That's a good rule of thumb. All right, and that's the rule of thumb that I want you to remember. This should be greater than or equal to. Greater than or equal to. And the rest of the stuff, you don't. You just know that it exists. Okay? Any questions? So, just a FYI, if you were so inclined to figure out, okay, you're in this area here, okay, well, you have to figure out how much clay, right, there's in the soil to figure out how much organic carbon you need. I just threw this in here. How do you determine how much clay there is in soil? Well, y'all probably had a lab in this, in soils class. And how did y'all figure out how to do that?
Feel it.
Yeah, the feel it, right? And it's still a very good technique to use in the field. If you have clay soil, the other thing is that's a good indication that soil is going to hold water. This is good for site inspections. If you're looking to see, hey, is this a good site to actually put a wetland impoundment? If you grab that soil and it falls apart in your hand, it's probably pretty porous. If you put water on, the water's going to drain right out of it. And you could pump continuously and it'll never hold water. So you want to have a good clay content in your soil so that you can hold water. So I think that is handout number 3 there, just to refresh your memory of the whole field method. And here's a kind of a diagram here. All right, so here's field testing. You know, you get a ball in your hand of soil, squeeze the ball crumbles, it's sand. Obviously, you're not in a clay situation. These numbers here, you will end up having to know. You don't really have to look really kind of out of place right now, other than we're talking about differences in soil sizes. But we're going to need to know this later on with respect to classifying wetlands, which is going to be next Monday, the Fish and Wildlife Service criteria. So sand, by the way, is 0.5 millimeters in size to 2 millimeters in size. So just, you can circle that right now, because you're going to need to know that at some point. Okay, clay, on the other hand, is less than 0.00002 millimeters in diameter. Okay, so it's quite a bit smaller. It a lot more particles, a lot of covalent type bonds that establish between those, and they hold water and all that type of stuff. So you're really in this area here of the chart. So when you end up pushing that soil between your thumb and your forefinger, you get a nice long ribbon. So you know that you have a clay soil. And again, that's a good indicator too, that it could be a good site for actually building an impoundment. All right. Now, there are lab techniques and lab methods, and I just thought that because I mentioned that at this point, that on the back, no, not on the back of there. Number four, number five are some really good websites that y'all should just, you know, just for your FYI, you know, for your reference. I guess starting with number five here, if you ever need to do any soil testing, University of Tennessee has a great lab, and it's relatively cheap. They'll do composition as far as the amount of silt and clay, sand that you have. They'll do nutrients, etc. And it's relatively, again, it's relatively cheap. Related to that, but a little bit different, just because we're talking about this, Tennessee Tech, on the back side of that, has an environmental quality lab which does water testing. If you ever need to do water testing, it's a great lab, relatively cheap, everything from nutrients to mostly nutrient testing, heavy metal testing, etc. What's that? Heavy metal, like mercury, for example, stuff that is being released into the environment, like from chemical plants and things like that, that shouldn't be released or were released back in the 70s and stuff before there were regs. The other site that is awesome, y'all, and this is very, very easy, is this is a NRCS site. It is a web soil survey, and you can get on there and find all the, not all soil maps, but most of the soil maps in the United States are now digital. There are still some areas where they're not digital yet, and there are a few places in Tennessee, but you can look at the maps and see where those exist. And you can, it literally is click and point, and you can create maps of soil, get soil maps, you can overlay roads on top of it and make a nice map. And anyways, this is an excellent website to go to. You should be aware of that. And just in mentioning all of this, obviously this is a wetlands class, but I'll bring in other things when I have the opportunity just to mention for professional development, like, for example, these things here that really aren't that important for the particular topic. Or like, for example, maybe catching bats down in Noxubee. Obviously that's not related to wetlands, although a lot of them like wetlands. Good. Any questions?
I have one, Dr. Gray.
Sure.
Talking about the organic versus mineral soils, yeah. That slide before this one.
Yeah.
What horizon is that based on?
Excellent question. What horizon is that based on? We will talk about that in two slides. Where do you collect that soil? Okay, where do you collect that soil? In fact, it's right on the back side of this. It's right below the A horizon. Okay, and there's a standardized depth that you go to. Good question. Okay, before we hit that though, just because this is a wetlands class, let's talk a little bit about the hydric organic soils, so not the fallest. So we have the saprist. Saprist are mucks, y'all. And saprist, again, if you think about a muck, grab muck, and the name itself means it's a bunch of junk, right? You really can't identify stuff, and it is. It's very black. There are, as far as the organic material on there, there's lots of organic material, but you can't identify the individual plant fibers very easily. So less than one-third of the plant fibers are identifiable. Over two-thirds are decomposed. And you could actually quantify this by taking that soil and ultimately a certain volume and certain weight and actually running it through sieves and separating the plant material and figuring out how much of that volume was actually composed of plants to drop it into this category. But just in general, what does this feel like? A field test, which is just fine as far as core is concerned, is if you rub it, it feels greasy and your hands get dirty. That is a field characteristic. So you're rubbing it, it feels greasy, and you know, your hands are covered with soil. Okay, they're dirty. Now, second is fibrist, which is a peat. Okay, this organic soil is not very decomposed. lots of organic matter, over two-thirds fibers, plant fiber, only a third decomposed, and when you rub it, again, you can feel the actual soil, the substrate itself, you can feel the fibers and your hands really remain clean. All right, so that leads us in between here, which are the hemist, and you have either mucky peats or peaty mucks. Okay, and so what's the difference here? It has to do with this range of, you know, of how much you have for plant fibers and how much is decomposed. So for these actually go in line with the classification. So for peaty mucks, they're mostly it is a muck that is peaty. Think of it that way, okay? It's a muck that is peaty. So it has over two-thirds of the fibers become destroyed after rubbing, whereas a mucky peat, two-thirds of the fibers remain after rubbing. Okay? Okay, I need to actually clarify something real quick. These don't go directly in line with each of the classes. This is the entire group of hemist can fall within this category. And the way that the peaty mucks separate from the mucky peats has to do with the amount of fibers, how much those fibers are decomposed. And a field test for that is that two-thirds of the fibers are destroyed in a peaty muck after rubbing. So it's mostly muck, okay? This is modifying. It's a muck that's sort of peaty, so it kind of, it's breaking down, has more stuff broken down. This is a peat that is sort of mucky, okay? So two-thirds of the fibers remain after you rub them. And those fibers, again, are a moderate amount of fibers. It's not a little bit, because if it was a little bit, it would just be a muck, and if it was a lot, it would be a fibrist. Okay? So is that clear? Outside of the different names that you don't know which goes first.
When we're in Mississippi, are we going to be able to do like a field test and see the difference between these, like actually feeding
them diamonds? Yeah, we should be able to. Yeah, we can go down because there's some permanently flooded areas that will definitely have organic soils. We'll be able to look at some of those criteria, you bet.
Are we going to have an auger or something with us? Or are we going to take a core sample?
Yeah, I can. I'll take down some core samplers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Other questions? Okay. So, back to Tyler's question. You know, where do you measure the soil characteristics? First of all, you measure using a soil probe like this, and I'll bring some down with us to Mississippi. And you look to see in that soil core, just generally, okay, a lot of times what we do, it needs to be, you're supposed to look at 16 inches. Go down to 16 inches, y'all. And right at that point of 16 inches, you can look around at that a band of a couple inches. Right at that point, what are the characteristics? And it's not just the organic content characteristic. It's all the other ones that I'll mention as well. Okay, so at that point you look and, you know, does there appear to be a lot of organic in that core? Well, in this case, does there? I know it's kind of hard to see, but do you see a lot of plant material in there? No, I don't. I mean, there's maybe a little bit there, here. It's mostly soil. So this certainly is a mineral soil. I mean, it's definitely not 20%. I mean, you're not seeing pieces of plants all, and it could be animals too, like if you see anything that's organic, for that matter. Usually plants are most easily seen. Okay. So, what are some characteristics? Here are two characteristics. Glaying and mottling are two characteristics. All right. So what I mean by that is when you take this core, you're going to see either a gray color, if you're in a hydric situation, a very gray color or gray streaking, and you may see some mottling, which is this red color. Okay, you may see little red striations in here as well, or mixed in with the gray. These are a consequence, it could have some blue-greenish color too. Those colors are a consequence of minerals within the soil. Excuse me. Wow. Still kind of getting over a cold. Minerals in the soil that are oxidized, going from an oxidized to a reduced state. And the reduced state of those chemicals ends up having a different color. And it becomes very diagnostic that, hey, anaerobic conditions occur, have occurred, are occurring, and therefore are used as a sign for for a hydric soil. Okay.